please welcome to the stage, Will Mountford.
Hello, Bristol. Good evening, good night, whatever time it is. I have been up since 3 a.m. and lost track of what's happening. Hello! Hello, welcome to the Bristol No Show. This is our second here at the Wardrobe Theatre and by far the most sold out. Thank you very much for coming. Give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you very much. Now, just as a quick survey of the crowd. Enthusiasm down the front, we're going to need that. Good. Just as a quick survey of the crowd, is everyone here looking for a good time? Yes?
Yes.
Everyone here looking for some entertainment? Yes?
Yes.
Guys looking for some science? Yes?
Yes.
Good, because we have a lot of science coming up. We've got pretty much every discipline from every corner of the universities around here that we can find, including some from across the bay. I feel like I should give a little bit of a caveat first. I'm not a scientist. I know. I was a scientist, I got better. What I do now is I'm a science communicator. And I mostly do that on the internet because, well, there's not 100 people staring at me on the internet. And I do that through various means. I do it mostly through a podcast called Eureka Nerd. Of course, podcasts are like assholes. I've got two of them. But that does mean that I have to read basically a lot of science. And there, do you guys know how much science there is? More than is enough. There is so much. Just, I'm going to be honest here. I know there's a child waiting to come in later. Sorry for this. It's bullshit. It's a lot of bullshit. And it's not even short. Like short, but like tweets are quite a lot of bullshit to deal with. But there is so much just abject bullshit going on out in the world. You think textbooks are bad? I have to read basically a textbook a day, and it's kind of driving me mad. Mostly, not just because of the science, but mostly because of the language. Any scientists in the audience, please give us a cheer. Hello. You know what you've done. Scientists, regardless of whatever language they speak, they come up with the most arcane and inane bullshit to put in their paper just to kind of make it look good, mostly to other scientists as well, because normal people don't read science. I'm not normal people. This is not what normal people do. But there is so much long-winded scientific acronyms. People fucking love acronyms. They will squeeze them in wherever they can. Even science itself, when it's properly formatted, is an acronym unto itself, apparently, these days. I'm not kidding. I found this on an American, the equivalent of year 9 revision website. How would you define science to 12-year-olds in America? And apart from being a sin unto God, this is how they would come up with it. And the worst part is, there are scientists out there who know about this, and they don't care. They, in fact, weaponize it in papers like this one from the British Medical Journal, 2017, their Christmas edition. Someone thought, oh, I'll have a laugh and come up with the most inane bullshit I can and give it an inane bullshit name. There is only one person who's done scientific, well, arcane bullshit better than scientists. And I have a test. I'm going to be doing some science at you. I'm going to do some science with all of you. Do you consent?
Yes!
Thank you very much. I have a test for you. I want to find out if you can tell the difference between science and Sweden. So, I am going to be throwing up some acronyms, some scientific terms, some names up here on the screen, and I want you all to shout out either science or Sweden. Can you give me a science?
Science!
Sweden!
Sweden!
Thank you very much. We're going to start off there's something a little bit easy for you. Billy. Any ideas? Yes, this is, of course, the classic bully bookcase. Next up, Steve.
Science.
Okay. As a quick survey, if you think it is science, raise your hands. If you think you can tell me what kind of science it is, keep your hands up. Okay. I've got someone in a red jump. Oh, no. Backing out. Yeah. You think it's robotics? Anyone else agree? Robotics, yes? No? Maybe? No, this is worse than robotics. This is space, where most of the arcane bullshit is. We have someone nodding their head down the front. That's why I didn't pick on you, Essie. Some people saw some weird stuff in the sky and thought, what will we call this weird, hitherto unknown aurora borealis effect? We've never seen anything like this. What shall we call it? They named it Steve. Because of a DreamWorks film released in 2011, I believe it was, there's a hedge that a turtle doesn't know the name of, so he calls it Steve. Scientists, being the nerds they are, thought, ooh, turtle didn't know a hedge. We don't know what the fuck is happening in space, so we'll call this Steve as well. Let's move on. Pomp! Science or Sweden, what do you think? No, this is not science. This is, in fact, a vase, I believe that is. So the pomp, vase. How about pope? Science or Sweden? Ooh, a good mix there. No, this is chemotherapy. That is the poly-ADP ribose inhibitors. Derp. Would anyone like to join me in 3, 2, 1, derp? Thank you. No, this, the derp, is Drug Effectiveness Review Project. This is some science here. What about Algot? Sweden, you think? You're right, this is a shoe rack. So we have the Algot shoe case. We have Algol. Now this is a star, more weird bullshit in space. How about the Solgol? Mm-hmm. Sweden, science. That is a baby-changing table. So we have the Solgol baby-changing table. Then we have the Solaron. Now that's a baton check. Go-kart! Science or Sweden? Ooh, that's a good mix. No, that is a different kind of... I think that's a mattress topper. The go-kart mattress topper. And macho! Ah, yes, so this is, again, some more weird space bullshit. Something to do with black hole halo objects. There are... Now, the science likes to work in pairs. So we have macho here. There is a counterpart to macho. What do we think? Girly, is that science or Sweden? Ooh, no. The girly is a pillow. The opposites are the wimps. We have machos and wimps because scientists, if you hadn't caught on by now, are huge fucking nerds. Dragon. Science or Sweden? I will admit, this is a trick question. This is both a kind of orbital launcher and a fork. It feels like they've cut... The pomple floople, whatever it is a vase, the dragon's a fork. But continuing on with the nerdy theme, Gandalf. Science or Sweden? Now that is the gas and absorption line fitting algorithm. So, Gandalf is science. What about fruit? Yes, that is exactly right. You might be sitting on some froze later this evening. I don't know if we've run out of bench space. So this is enough of my science arcane bullshit, because we have an entire evening of inane science bullshit coming up for you. I believe one of our acts is already cheering on his arcane science bullshit. Because we have searched far and wide, some of you might have seen that some of our previous shows before, but first of all, starting off our first half, we have Joe Daly from the University of Bristol. Let me just make sure. Oh, sorry. I forgot. I had a joke coming up here, but I forgot. Something-something scientists don't know shit. There we are. So, I want to give you a bit of a practice for your rounds of applause before we welcome Joe Daly to the stage. Give me a round of applause for there being a sale in IKEA. Okay, that's pretty good. I want to take it another notch higher. Give me a round of applause if there's a sale in IKEA and they're giving away meatballs. I think there's a little bit more left in you, so I want you to clap and cheer and whoop as hard as you can as if there was a sale in IKEA with free meatballs and they're filming an advert where kittens run loose! That's more like it. Everyone, please welcome to the stage, Joe Daly!
Yes, I am small. Hello, yes, I am Joe. I'm a student at the Bristol Robotics Lab, and I study, unsurprisingly, robotics. But I'm also interested in the other way up. Art. So this kind of happened. And in a world where there is a lot of bullshit, such as bananas taped to a wall selling for over $100,000, it's worth starting thinking about what the hell is art? According to the all-knowing Google, expression of or application of human creative skill and yada yada yada. Nobody really cares. the key point that I'm kind of drawn to here is a specifically human aspect of this, and I feel like it's discrimination against robots. But people are kind of worried about robots taking their jobs and stuff, so maybe it's worth saying that it's just humans. But there is a wonderful website called willrobotstakemyjobs.com. Which suggests that artists may be safe. They might be all right for a little while. But it turns out there are actually robots making some art already. And we're going to play a little game I like to call Humans versus Robots, Art Edition, which implies the existence of other humans versus robots. There isn't. This is the first. So if you, basically, very simple, which one is the human artist here? I guess... Let's see, left versus right, and just shout your answer, I guess. So, human or robot? you're left. Which one's the human artist? Ooh, okay, mixed bag. It is, in fact, the human artist is on the right. The left-hand one is a robot just literally drawing scribbles in a random direction centered on one point. All these robot artists were featured in a competition last year, a robot art competition. So we have another entry here. We're feeling left. Left is... You would be correct if you said left. That is one of the winning teams. Although I'm not entirely convinced that the right one is not a robot, because I don't understand how anyone could follow this apparently tutorial on how to draw Steve Jobs. We have another two. This one of these sells for the original painting for £111. The other is a robot creation. What do we think? A bit of a mixed bag. So the right-hand one is the human artist. The left-hand one, once again, is the robot. sometimes robots can do some good stuff. In robotics, we like to try and portray robots in a positive light. However, I do somewhat question the accompanying video for this particular entry to the competition, describing its painting technique as the stabbing method. It's questionable at best. Okay, once again. Ooh, very mixed. Okay. So the human artist again was on the right. Not a creature of habit at all with the way I'm setting these up. So this one is a bit of a collaboration. I say collaboration. They're all sort of collaborations between humans and robots. This one, the human sort of inputs an image and the robot creates it. The previous examples we saw of the last couple were ones where a human painted the picture and the robot just recreated those brush strokes. This is a bit more autonomy. Okay, my final favorite is one of these went to auction for €2,000. Which, given recent news, could be worth a lot more. So, yeah, who do we think is the human artist, left or right? Human artist is on the right again. However, the left-hand artist is a sentence that one doesn't usually expect to hear: a robot snake drawing in time to metal music. This genuinely is a thing that was shown at a conference that I've been trying to get a paper accepted to for several years. And this work, I mean, to be fair, it is art. The robot itself is possibly more art than its creation. But yes, it is creating art at a time vaguely with some metal music. But a lot of these raise the question of is it actually being creative? Is it actually doing something meaningful in its machine brain? And the debate is kind of out there, but to sort of explore this idea of robots creating something, no discussion of robot creativity is quite complete without a mention of Deep Dream. And in advance, I'll say, if you have trypophobia, I think it's a thing of like a fear of like little small holes and stuff, this might not be for you. It's very surreal. This is some of the stuff that emerges from Deep Dream. So the way this basically works is you input a whole bunch of images to this neural network, and it sort of figures out over time that, oh, this collection of pixels and stuff, this looks like a cat, this looks like something else. And basically what happens with this, which we can sort of see happening in this music video, which takes an ordinary scene, is like looking at a cloud, basically. You think, oh, that cloud, that looks a little bit like a face. You see the lines there. And basically the neural network is doing something kind of similar. The particular pattern of activation across this network results in something that looks like it thinks it looks like something else. But the creative aspect of this is that it basically takes that and then sort of back propagates to the original picture and changes it to make it look more like what it thinks it looks like. And then you can keep feeding it through and making it look more and more weird. And this is something that if you just go on Google and like go to Deep Dream, you can find a webpage and upload your own pictures and do this for yourself and keep running it through like this person has with their selfie. And create some weird stuff. Although it does come with a slight health warning because, well, health warning, don't do this at work, basically. People be uploading some very, it's a bit straight up porn. People are just, so, and turning it into, I mean, yeah, interesting things. So if you're into that, go wild, I guess. I'm judging. And I had a go with some white noise just to see what it would do. And we kind of end up with this kind of eldritch thing. There's some like weird legs, hanging around there. But yeah, so another type of neural network, which people are very excited about in terms of creating new works, has a very fancy name. Again, we're back to our bullshit, of generative adversarial network, which basically means it's taking a bunch of stuff, smushing it together into new stuff. And this has been sort of very effective in creating these. These never existed. These are not by human hands at all. These are generated by a neural net. And they look perfectly convincing. And again, this is something, this is called Art Reader, which you can go on and you can sort of input images and stuff to it to create some new things, which is pretty exciting. So you can make your own portraits, album covers, or your favorite anime girl, I guess. So there is, yeah. And this kind of technology has been used again in the art competition to make some, actually take it one stage further. And this is a robot that's been entered for several years to this competition and has been getting better and better and ranked first last time. And it creates some stuff. And there's still a kind of question, is it actually art? Is it actually creating something? What does it mean? And people have been debating, going back and forth. I have read somebody's thesis, master's thesis, 53 pages, discussing this and discussing the various like points of its artistic merits, so the sort of replication of this image and what does it mean and is it actually thinking? And to be honest, the conclusion it basically boils down to, I still don't know. And one of the interesting things that they kind of bring up is how people respond to it and whether you can look at an image by these machines and get any artistic value out of it. And one of the things we saw was like the confusion initially about is it a robot artist, is it not? It's less about the artist and it's as much about the audience, really. And it's about you guys. Thank you. That's me.
Everyone, keep it going for the very short, I suppose, Joe Daly! Yeah. So I'm just trying to size up our next speaker. I'm just going to leave this here. Everyone, you just did a very good job applauding. I'll ask you to do the same again. Please welcome to the stage our next act, Dr. Ezzy Pearson!
Yes, so I am Ezzy Pearson. I used to be an astrophysicist, but then I got better. And now I work as a science bullshit translator, otherwise known as a science writer. And I'm currently writing a book, and whilst I was researching that, I came across this particular story that I'm about to tell you now. So I'd like to take you back, if I may, to the year 1959. It's the middle of the Cold War. 2 years ago, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik into the space. And overnight, they changed from a world where America was the global military superpower to one where Russia was suddenly the most technologically advanced. And In 1959 alone, the Soviets launched not one, not two, but three probes to the moon. There was Luna 1, which went past it, Luna 2, which slammed into it, and Luna 3, which went around it. Meanwhile, in the US, they had attempted to launch Vanguard, which was their answer to Sputnik. And it managed to make it 4 feet off the ground and then fell over and exploded. Fortunately, nobody was around to see it. Oh, no, wait, sorry. The entirety of the world's media was filming and recording and photographing the entire thing. They were a laughingstock worldwide. The US eventually managed to get into space with Explorer 1, but by that point, they were already a laughingstock. There was a space race going on, and the US were categorically losing. And I don't know if you know this about the US, they're not very good losers. So they did the only thing that makes any sense in a situation like that, and they got the CIA to kidnap a spaceship. Specifically, they got the CIA to kidnap a model of Luna 3. So that was the Soviet spacecraft that went into orbit around the moon. And Luna 3 was a pretty amazing spacecraft. It was one of the first ones that had solar panels. Before Luna 3, basically what you had was you had a battery power, and as soon as your battery ran out, your spaceship was dead. With solar panels, you could recharge as you went, which meant you could have a longer mission. You could go into orbit. and it also meant you could have a much beefier, bigger instrument on board. Specifically, you could have a camera. And when I say a camera, this was before digital cameras were even an idea. So this camera took film, developed it, dried it, scanned it in, sent it back, whilst in space. Sometimes I think it's just easier to, you know, like, invent the new thing, but, you know, whatever. And what Luna 3 managed to do was it took the first ever pictures of the far side of the moon. And this wasn't just a technological breakthrough. This was a cultural shift. No human eyes had ever seen the far side of the moon before. So the Soviets were justly proud of what they'd done, and they decided to put on this great big exhibition of Luna 3, and the big pièce de résistance was going to be a model of Luna 3 that all the Soviets would go and see, and it was going to tour around all of the Soviet states. Now, at that time, it was, of course, 1960s at this point, it was the middle of the Cold War. So there were one or two CIA intelligence operatives, spies, hanging around in Soviet Russia. And they broke in to one of the exhibits after hours and had a really good look at what they thought was a model. And the more they looked at it, the more they realized, this isn't a model. This is like an actual flight-worthy spaceship that the Soviets, like an idiot, have just put on tour for everybody to see. I mean, they've cut a couple of holes in it and ripped out all the electronics so it wouldn't work. But the CIA operatives realized that this was a chance to actually learn something about how the Soviets were managing to do this. So they took a bunch of pictures, but they realized what they really wanted to do was to take this lovely lady to one side and have a good night with her. And to do that, they were going to have to borrow her, steal and kidnap. They were going to bring her back, so I suppose it's more kidnapping. So obviously, how do you kidnap a spaceship? Well, the first thing is you work out when the best time to nab it is. And the best time is when it's in transit. So they found out that the exhibit, as it was touring around all of the Soviet states, Luna 3 was getting loaded up onto a truck. That truck was then going to a freight train. The freight train went to the next town, back onto the truck, next to the next exhibit center. Initially, they were going to try and just steal the freight car, because apparently that's a thing that people do outside of movies. But realized they couldn't find a good spot to do it. So instead, they realized what they were going to do is they were going to try and get it whilst it was on the truck. So the night comes. They removed the driver and kept him in a hotel room. The official report that is a little bit shady about how they do it, but the fact that nobody says, I'm just going to assume it involved a lot of vodka, blackjack, and hookers. I'm just going to go ahead and assume that. And then they drove it to a nearby junkyard with 10-foot high fences so nobody would see them. And then we had four operatives who were known as the factory team, for reasons I don't know, who were going to try and take a look at it. Now, at the time, Luna 3 was in a box. So the first thing they had to do was try and crack it open. And they did that with ladders, ropes, a nail puller, drop lights, flashlights, extension cords, screwdrivers, hammers, a crowbar, and a set of metric wrenches. I just love the fact that in the official CIA kit list, they had to mention the fact that Russia is metric. So there was four guys in the team. Two of them were setting up the cameras. Two of them were on top of the box trying to crack it open. Now, I'm just going to read from you from the official write-up in Studies in Intelligence, an issue that has since been declassified. As far as I can tell, Studies in Intelligence is basically the CIA magazine where you can brag about all the cool shit you've done, such as kidnapping a satellite. Our first task was to remove enough of the crate's roof to get in. It was made of 2-inch, apparently they haven't got the metric message. It was made of 2-inch tongue and groove planks nailed down with 5-inch spikes. Two members of the team went to work on these, perspiring and panting in the humid air. Official write-up. The effort not to leave traces of our forced entry was made easier by the fact the planks had been removed and put back several times before, so were already battered. While this was going on, there was a rather unnerving incident. When we had arrived at the salvage yard, it was dark. The only lights were in the salvage company's office. Now, with two men on top of the crate prying up planks, street lamps suddenly came on, flooding the place with light. Hello? We are ordinary Soviet workmen in ordinary Soviet junkyard with ordinary, very convincing Soviet accent. We are doing very ordinary activity of opening box whilst photographing is unboxing video. Be very popular in 50 years' time. Turned out that actually it was just the lights were on a timer. They were fine. No one knew that they were there. Cracked open the lid of the box, realized that Luna 3 filled this entire bloody thing. There was no room to get inside, so they had to lower themselves down from the top. Now, it doesn't say that they, like, Tom Cruised in Mission Impossible in, but it doesn't say they didn't, so I think we all know what happens. But what they did is they levered open some of the observation windows and actually climbed inside the Luna 3 spacecraft. They took their shoes off first. They weren't complete heathens. And then measured and photographed every single thing that they could until they got to the payload. So the payload in a spacecraft is the actual, you know, bit that you care about. It's the scientific bit that you're actually trying to get into space in the first place. And this is kind of like a big silver ball, like a big egg, and that had all the cameras and stuff in. And so they got this out, took all of their photos, made all of their measurements, and had enough so that back home the boys would at least, even if they couldn't backwards engineer anything, they could at least know what the Soviets were doing, know what they were up against. And then, the exploitation of Luna Nick is now complete. All that remained was to put things back together and close up the crate. The first job, resecuring the orb in its basket, proved to be the most ticklish and time-consuming part of the whole night's work. They managed to tickle the orb back into place, replace the rest of the spacecraft, nail it all back up. No one was any the wiser. They went, they got the driver back. Apparently he had a very good time, because no one's ever heard about it since. And in fact, nobody knew anything about this project at all until 1995, when the report that I took all that from was finally declassified. And that is how you kidnap a spaceship.
Thank you very much. A round of applause for Orb Tickling! We have some tickling fans in. Okay, and keep the applause coming for the next act we have tonight. Please put your hands together for, if you remember him from last time, the careless crisperer himself, Steve Litherland!
So good evening, ladies and gentlemen, how are we doing? Right, before I trip up, make sure that's going the right way. Yes, it is. So I've come to talk to you tonight about viruses, specifically, an approach to model design of outbreaks of novel viruses and the efficacy of antiviral strategies. Otherwise known as, why viruses are slippery bastards that sub right off. So, can I have a little bit of hands up? Who's been ill recently? Yeah. It's quite a lot of you, actually. And to be honest, if I hear a cough out of any of you, right, that's attempted murder. So behave. Right. So probably the culprit that we're going to be looking at is this cheeky chappy. Influenza. So this is a very simple virus. And as you can see, it's just got a couple of loops of RNA and a little bit of a shell. So it's very simple and it can constantly change itself. And is a complete git. Because as you've seen, it gets everywhere. It gets absolutely everywhere. Now, what we can see from this diagram is it basically consists of this RNA, which is its genetic code, and two outer proteins. And these proteins are hemagglutinin and uraminidase. And that's basically all it is. And these proteins interact with your cells. So this is how they get in, get into your cells. And they constantly change them. So this is why you keep getting sick from the same little bastard. Right? And you do recognize this. Different strains are H1N1. You know, we've heard of swine flu. And bird flu, H5N1. So this is how they sit and change. And they go round and your body doesn't recognize them. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to simulate an infection with you. Sorry, getting ahead of myself. How complex is it? It's 13,500 base pairs, and that equates to about 3,375 bytes of data, which is tiny. And if you look at this lovely photo of me with my first anatomy textbook. This blurry image of me in the 90s is 25,000 bytes. That's 7.4 viral genomes in that data alone. So very simple. So yeah, as I was saying, I'm now going to go on and simulate a virus infection amongst the audience. And I'm going to need some volunteers. If volunteers required. So I know the front row is looking fairly nervous, but actually, I'm going to need all of you. Okay, so can we get the house lights up? Actually, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain to you.
Can you all still hear me?
So as it goes round, this is effectively you being infected by this model. Now this model's... There we go, we got our first one. So this is effectively, in a population, as people interact with each other, the virus continues around. Thank you. Louder, I want to hear a louder sod off, Steve. I want to hear you. I want to sod right off. So, but this model has limitations. So, in real life, a virus doesn't affect just... It doesn't just infect one person. It could infect multiple people. With viruses as well, with the bird flu and the swine flu, they can have an animal reservoir. where the virus exists within an animal population, therefore cannot be entirely eradicated. Hey! I expected some heckling, but not the amount of abuse I'm getting, quite frankly. So this is a model we design with any sort of novel virus coming out. I didn't expect this to throw me off so much. So we're trying to model the spread of an infection, and then we're trying to ascertain how much damage this is going to do. So how's our virus? How's Steve getting on? So hands up if you're infected. So as you can see in this, it's fairly kind of, you know, it gets around quite a bit. So this is how, so even with an infection number of one, only infecting one other human, it's already got round an entire audience. So how can we prevent these? What strategies can we use to prevent these? So one thing is the idea of herd immunity. I'm sure you've all heard it. But if everyone could return their paper planes to me. I think that went about as well as I expected. Okay. So I want to demonstrate to you herd immunity. So if you could take a sod off. If you could take a sod off. If you could take a sod off. And one for you. And one for you. And I will get one for you. Your very own sod off. Whoops. Told you I was going to trip up. Now, if you had one infection here, and you try and pass it off to across the audience, how far do you reckon you're going to get? Not far at all. And this is one of the techniques we use for antiviral spread. Now, there are a couple of other techniques. So we have quarantine. We have antivirals, which again wasn't in our model. And we have our vaccination. And this is why, in a new novel virus, trying to find a vaccine is incredibly important. Trying to quarantine is incredibly important. So, speaking of viruses and science bullshit, this is the designated name of the new virus, the coronavirus, yes. Otherwise known as 2019-nCoV, which is incredibly catchy. Now, I wrote this show, well, I started writing this show about 2 weeks ago, and I was going to be slightly callous about it. But since then, there has been 25,000 cases. Now, when I started, there was about 2,000 cases with about 50 mortalities. So it really turns out Wuhan cold ain't nothing to fuck with. Thank you. So when people ask, like, how dangerous is this virus? And this is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to make a model of what the impact of this is going to be. From bat soup. I would try and say yes or no, but I'd be winging it. There we go. So, that's fair, you know what? Yeah, I'll give you that. So, yeah, coronaviruses can be carried by bats. So, this is what I was talking about, the animal reservoir, where it's not really reliable to sort of wipe out the virus just by trying to target human infections alone. It is carried by bats. So, what can we do to stop the spread of the virus? Well, first of all, wash your hands. Yeah? Yeah, because that's how viruses spread, is wash your hands. Second of all, face masks. During intercourse, if you wear a face mask, I mean, that's not much to do with the virus, it's just something you're a bit not much to look at. No, it's all right. No unprotected sex with domestic animals. And quite frankly, if you must indulge in bestiality, go wild. So don't be a hero. Now, this really pisses me off. Is if you're ill, stay home from work. Don't inflict it on other people. Don't splurge. You know the one person that I've never had a sick day. It's just like, I really wish you would have. You know, spluttering in the out of the office. You know, sod off, Steve. Yeah. And it is. It's the co-worker has a two-hour nap because he's feeling a bit peaky, but he's still coming to work. And don't be a dickhead. Yeah? Don't cough on a baby. Don't rub your bogeys into old people. Yeah? I feel like I shouldn't have to say these things, but I do. That's the day and age we've come to. So the final verdict then is, will the new coronavirus wipe out all of humanity? Probably not. You know, be careful. Probably not. But I'll give you some stats. So the SARS, there was 750 cases, mortalities. So far, there have been 500 mortalities from the coronavirus. In the United States alone, 600 people per year die from autoerotic asphyxiation. And to be honest, if you need a weird death stat, people having a cheeky strangle wank is always the one to go for. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Somehow, airplanes flying around and discussion of the choke and stroke has taken me right back to year 9. I don't know why it's flashbacks. But anyway, that is it for our first half. We're about to go on a break for about 15 minutes. So I'll be coming back in here once all the appropriate fluids have left and then re-entered your body. That'll be at 8:35. But before you open the doors and head out, can we have a round of applause, first of all, for Joe Daly? For Ezzy Pearson? And for Steve Litherland? Thank you very much. We'll see you again in 15 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen and non-binary friends, please welcome to the stage, Will Mountford.
Well, this is a problem. Just to check, are we plugged in? Oh, hey! Oh, a ripple of pity there, fantastic. Okay, has everyone had a good intermission, yes? Yes! Everyone enjoy the first half, yes?
Yes!
Is everyone ready for more science, yes?
Yes!
Bad news, more of my bullshit first. So, you guys remember the rules, science or Sweden? Quick practice round, science!
Science!
Sweden!
Sweden!
Okay, I think we're ready to start. First things first, pasta! As much as I am a fan of all things carbohydrate, this is unfortunately a science. I know, the disappointment of it not just actually being pasta. That's my day-to-day. This isn't pasta, what the fuck? Has lust. Oh, you're exactly right. Can anyone has a guess as to what has lust might be on the IKEA shelves? Any guesses? Wardrobe?
Coffee table.
Coffee table. Unfortunately, this is seasonal wrapping paper. So if you happen to look at a bunch of Santas and think, oh, then maybe the haslust is for you. Smack sack! Much like the derp from the second half, if you'd like to join me in 3, 2, 1, smack sack! Oh, means no worries for the rest of your days. No, what it means is extraction oven. And, Antigone. Oh, you're very, very resistant to my influence. This is, of course, antigens. What about antigen? I know. Ain't I a stinker? No, this is scrubbing up brushes. Okay, I believe this is pronounced decade. Science. No, shouting science is the right thing to do. You're fine. You're wrong, but you're fine. Now, this is a clock. So, decade. Clock. Sniffer.
Science.
That's a clock. Pug.
Science.
That's a clock. Flip. No, that's chemotherapy again. Moofed. Ooh, a good mix there. Now, this is a non-uniform fast Fourier transformation, which I am led to believe is a science. Muff. Swedish muff is definitely in somebody's search terms here tonight, but no, this is muff like sarcoma. It's a cancer thing again. Sorry about that. Formidable. Ooh. Now, you see, this is the kind of thing that scientists would like to have named Formidable. They'd like to... No, unfortunately, it's a plastic bowl. And lastly, Swede!
Yes.
Exactly right. This is about studies of work environment and disease epidemiology in Swedes. I'll continue to wrestle with this. Now, I'd like to say, first of all, thank you so much for your enthusiasm. And if you'd like to let me know how you did overall, then I'd be around after the show. You can tell me how that went. And my wife is swearing at me. That's an evening well done. But enough about my weird science stuff. It is time to keep going with the rest of the show. You guys ready for our next act? Yes! Okay, please put your hands together and start clapping as loud as you could for an IKEA with a sale with the meatballs, which are vegan this time. Thank you very much, and please welcome to the stage, Sarah Cosgrave!
Hello, sorry, I thought that it was me second, but never mind. Okay. Hello. Hello. How are you all doing? You doing good? Well, thank you so much for having me. My name's Sarah, and I work for the Institute of Physics. That was a much more positive reaction I was expecting, so thank you. So we work with lots of different people. We work with members, so these are people who work out in physics and physics-related fields, but we also work with the public. So my team particularly works with schools, so we're the education team. I've been there for about 2-ish years, and in those 2 years, I've actually been holding on to a deep, dark secret I'm going to share with you all now. I'm actually not a physicist. Yes, I am actually a biologist. I know. I think they might be onto me. And to be fair, I've been leaving the clues around for a while. So, for example, I have no idea what my colleagues talk about most of the time. And they just think I'm a really good listener. Or there was a time that my colleagues organised a pub quiz for our members, which is a really nice thing to do. You want to thank your members. And they said, oh, you should come along. And I said, yes. You know, pub quizzes are really fun. This was a physics pub quiz. One of the rounds was famous mathematical equations in physics. So my team were really nice to me, but I could tell that they really wanted me to go immediately. And then the other day, one of my colleagues was talking to me about astronomy, which is a really exciting area. And I said, yeah, astronomy, that's like star signs and stuff, right? I'm actually not into star science and astrology. I just really enjoy winding up physicists. By the way, top tips, if you want to wind up biologists, I have a couple suggestions for you. So the things that we tend to get a lot is, oh, well, if evolution's real and if we came from monkeys and monkeys still exist, then how is that possible? We get that tons, and quite frankly, I'm bored. So if you really want to change things up, I have a couple suggestions for you. You could go along the lines of saying something like, I really like Richard Dawkins. Or something along those lines. Or if you really want to be a complete dick, you could say something like, biology isn't that just physics for girls? You think people don't say it, but they do. They do. So talking about biology, I actually, I wasn't going to tell you the story, but seeing how much his name has been mentioned tonight, I had a friend who was doing a microbiology and virology degree at the same time I was doing a biology degree, and she was doing a virology lab, which involved injecting viruses into eggs. She called all of her eggs Steve. Absolutely true. So she called them Steve 1, Steve 2, Steve 3, all the way up, and except for this very special egg called Balthazar. So the area of biology I come from is cell biology. One of the research I used to do many moons ago was something called cell migration. And this is when we were looking at why cells move in interesting and funky ways when they're not really meant to, kind of like a Tory MP trying to get down with the kids. Is that joking a little bit too soon? And we use fluorescence microscopy in order to do this. So this is when we get a fluorescent protein, we tag it onto a cell, a part of a cell, because cells are actually really busy and packed places. If any of you remember doing GCSE biology, it's all a lie. It's actually really packed full of stuff. So you get your protein, you attach it to wherever you want to look at. You then would shine a light. So you get the cells underneath the microscope, shine a light, and basically it would absorb that light and emit back a different color. So just to give an example off the top of my head, let's say purple, if you shine a purple light, and then it absorbs it and then emits a green light back. So you can actually kind of follow the cells really nicely, and you can take pictures of them. So you can take like a picture sort of every 2 minutes, and then you can build up a film, and it kind of looks and kind of crawls across the screen. And this is our way of understanding how the cell mechanics work for understanding things like metastasis and cancer. So it's when you have kind of try to understand why cells move from one tumor to a different part of the body. So this is why we were studying cell migration. You can also stain cells, so you can actually get fixed cells in time and then throw loads of color on it. Basically, fluorescent microscopy can be a lot like coloring in or, you know, geography. Okay, I've got to admit, that was a very cheap joke. I'm sorry to any geographers out there, whether here or anywhere else. The thing is, I find that we do a lot of subject bashing. Do you know what I mean? But we don't need to, because they make fun of themselves. So I was at an event like this a few years ago where the MC of the night said, are there any scientists in the audience? And somebody put their hand up and said, does psychology count? So we don't actually need to make fun of them. What was I going to talk about next? Oh, yes. So in order to do my experiments, I had to culture cells. And no, that's not like taking them to the theater or anything like that. Sorry, bad cell biology joke. So we grow them up in flasks. We put them in an incubator to around the sort of same 37 degrees, so body temperature. We'd feed them every so often. And I just found that when we were looking after cells, it's a lot like having children. They don't understand the concept of weekends. They can sometimes be a little bit fussy about their food, and if you throw them an alcohol, they die. You don't know what I've actually done, and that'll mean their mystery. Talking of children, I was walking home one day, back home from the train station through town in Swindon, where I live, and in case you're wondering, yes, I did choose to live in Swindon. Yes. I walked past the Tesco and there was a circle of children around there. And I saw there was one, so it was a group of teenagers, one that was in the middle, and they were trying to do that Mentos and Coke thing, if anybody's ever done that. I don't know why outside of a Tesco. They were just there. But yeah, if you're not familiar with it, basically if you put a load of Mentos into Coke, it then spurts up, it goes everywhere, kids love it because it's very messy. The thing is, they were doing it wrong. They were only putting one Mento, what, I don't know what the singular of a Mento is, whatever it is, they were only putting one in, so it doesn't do that much. So it kind of looked a little bit disappointing and went there. And I almost stepped in to say they were doing it wrong until I realized I am a grown up talking to children I don't know, and that would be a bad thing. So I stepped away. But I don't know if you ever had this where you sometimes have to switch that part of your brain off or stepping in or saying something. And I feel that I've been a scientist out the lab for a few years, but I feel like sometimes I haven't quite left. The lab hasn't left me. So if there are any science researchers in the audience who are looking to leave research, first of all, good for you. But I thought I'd give you some advice on how you can transition to work. Some things that really helped me a lot when I first left research. So first of all, something that really, really helped me. It is okay to hate Brian Cox. Thank you. Non-scientists love him, and I still don't know why. Second of all, people will ask you science questions, and that's perfectly normal, and that's absolutely fine. So where I last worked, I worked in a youth charity where I was the science expert. I was one of the more knowledgeable people with science in that particular organization. And I had a colleague come up to me, Nigel. He said to me, he just came up to me one day and said, Sarah, I want to ask you a science question. And I thought, oh, okay. I said, yes, Nigel, what is your question? And he looked at me, and then he said, why doesn't my cat like me? So you get some good questions and you get some less good questions. And finally, for someone who works at a physics organization who doesn't know any physics, and I'm expecting my termination of contract any day now, sometimes people will ask you physics questions and you won't know the answer. So I just say, physics, innit? Thank you so much. You've been a lovely audience.
Applause, please, for Sarah. Now, I don't know if any of you were at one of our nights we did maybe a year and a half ago now. It's called the Agony Uncles of Science, combination of aunt and uncle. It's a science panel show where you could ask scientists questions and get very bad responses. Like if you ask a physicist for dating advice, get prepared for, my favorite pickup line ever is, hey babe, do you want to make like the particle accelerator and smash together at high speeds to better figure out our place in the world? But if any panelists were getting too far up themselves, we did have the Cox block, a red card with Brian Cox's face that you could slam on the table and tell him to shut the fuck up about things they don't know about. But that's a topic for my therapist. Let's move on with our next act of the night. Everyone, please put your hands together for Claudia and Delaney!
Feeling a bit short. All right, so I heard you were practicing this before, so we're just going to freshen it up because we're going to need it for the end of my talk. What do you do when you hear the word science? Science! Well, yeah, that's the one. Well done. So, yeah, it has been very fun so far. Yeah, been enjoying it? Yeah. Good, because I'm here to bring the mood down. Yeah. So my performance had initially some trigger warnings. So if you want to leave because of trigger warnings, you're absolutely welcome to. If you want to leave because you think I'm not going to be funny, you're also welcome to. But you might be missing out, just saying. So my piece will mention depression and suicide and many other not very funny things. So I trigger warnings in my case are a spoiler alert. But so I like challenges. That's why I got a PhD in astrophysics. Then I stopped being an astrophysicist, and that's when I got depressed. So another cool story for another day, though. So I decided to come to a comedy night to do a piece about depression and make it funny. Be kind to me. So in case you're not able to read it, my shirt says, I'm not insane. My mother had me tested. And fun fact, only one of those statements is true. Again, next time. So, yeah, the one thing that I hope you're going to get home from with space is that your life is going to be a little longer. Bear with me. We're going to get there in the end. So if there's one thing that you should know about depression is that it sucks. But not as in it's a sad, horrible, miserable disease. It literally sucks stuff out of you, sucks out your life, your joy to live, your enjoyment for everything that you used to like the day before. Gone. Forget it. You're going to sit there, feel very sorry for yourself, be an empty shell of what you used to be. It's about as fun as I am making it sound right now. It's, oh God, it's boring as hell being depressed. It's appalling, honestly. You sit there and you self-loathe. Ooh, the joys. It's almost like listening to Brian Cox. The other thing that really sucks about being depressed is this stuff that people tell you when you tell them that, you know, you're suffering from it. And I wrote down a few. So, you should try taking more walks in the park. Yep, tried it. Still depressed. Have you tried not being depressed? Which is about as helpful as telling someone with a broken leg, have you tried not having a broken leg? Thanks, but no thanks. All right, next. You've always been the one to take yourself way too seriously. And so I came here on a comedy night to laugh about this shit, so they got nothing on me now. Right? And this last one is my favorite. Oh, but you don't look depressed. Shoot! I forgot my huge I'm a depressed person sign at home again! What? People are weird. Luckily, people have never been depressed before, probably. Otherwise, they wouldn't say this stuff. But I'm glad for them, because the other way around is pretty sad, literally. So, yeah. Being depressed is like being stuck in watching a reel of your worst fears, your worst flaws, everything that makes you inherently unlovable. No one can ever, ever like you again. Over and over and over and over. Stop me whenever. So it's like you're binge watching a really, really boring show. Think of the most boring show you've ever watched. Yeah, something like that. There's very, very few plot twists. Like after a while, you will stop finding reasons why you should hate yourself. It sounds weird, but it does happen. You come up with a few new ones after a while, but mostly it's all the same stuff. You know, I don't know, you're fat, you're ugly, no one has ever liked you. You think about, like, all the people that picked on me in primary school. I remembered all of that. That's what depression does to your brain. Brings out all the worst stuff that ever happened to you, like, bang, bang on. So you're stuck there, binge watching this horrible, horrible series, realize you don't like the main character that much. Maybe that's why they call them depressive episodes. And spoiler alert, season 2 is also horrible. I hope Netflix never picks up this as an idea. That would be really, really, really bad. So the good news is, mood up, you can get better from depression. I did, and this is the first time tonight I'm talking about in front of an audience. So, yay. So, you can get better, but it's still a terribly stigmatized subject. Depression, mental health, many other diseases associated with this are still incredibly unknown. We are very, very scared to talk about them because as a society we don't deal with emotions that well. I get this impression, I'm not sure if that's shared or not. So discussing about this and trying to have a good cheer is not only helpful for people that do suffer from it, or people that are recovering, people that survived, and lifting the stigma is also, especially because, like, how many people do we have here tonight? A bunch? Yeah, statistically, statistically, one in four people in the UK will experience problems with mental health over their lives. So if it's not you, it might be your neighbor. If it's not your neighbor, like, I mean, in your chair, it could be someone that you know, some of your friends, some of your family, some of your colleagues. So it's a terribly widespread thing. And it really sucks that we're not allowed to talk about it. But the other reason that you really, really should consider talking about depression and mental health problems is that it has been proven by science that discussing suicidal thoughts, talking about suicide, being open about it, decreases your odds of going through with it. So by listening to me tonight, I have extended maybe a tiny bit your life expectancy. So you know that joke that people say, oh, you know, ask for the, like, the money for your ticket back, and people say, oh, I'm never gonna get back my time though. I'm like, nope. Not with me. So good luck with getting your money back, but I did give back some of your time. So the reason why I ask you, or rather I would say I urge you to talk about it, is that you could save someone's life. I know that for me, being able to talk about it, I mean, tonight, laugh about it in front of a lot of strangers that don't, can't really see their faces. it really did help with therapy and lots of other things. But I really, really ask you to think about it and spread the word with friends, colleagues, family, and make someone else's life longer too. Thank you.
No applause for Claudia Angelini. Also, by a quick cheer, where are my serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors at? Yes? Down at the front. Fantastic. Well, next up we have an improv group from Bristol called the Jazz Police. I've just had an extra member slip in the back, so he's going to be scuppering down the stairs in the dark. Good luck with that. But if you're all, please put your hands together for the Jazz Police. A round of applause for both the comedy and also the stage cleaning skills of the Jazz Police! There we are. We are almost done for the night, but just before we part ways, I'd like to say that this evening has been brought to you by Psy by Southwest. You can find us on Twitter at PsyXSW. Hopefully some people get the joke that this is a riff on the Film and Culture Festival. We're not PsyX Southwest, as we were called on Bristol Radio today. Guy from BBC Radio looks at us and goes, ooh, science and comedy. So, I've been doing this for 7 fucking years, yeah. Yeah, you can do both, yeah. But you can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us all over the place. You can find us at psyxsouthwest.co.uk. The next Bristol No Show will be here in about 4.5 months' time on June 22nd. If you have seen something that you enjoyed, you might be able to come back and see it. If you have been in this show and thought, oh, I could do that. I have clinical depression and a PhD. Which, they co-occur more...
then you can come share that with us as well. But until then, we'll be probably doing something in the next couple of months. You can find out about it on the website, through social media. But all that is left for tonight is to give a big round of applause to all of our acts. So can we start with a round of applause for Joe Daly? A round of applause for Ezzie Pearson! A round of applause for Steve Liveland! A round of applause for Sarah Cosgrave! For Claudia Adelini! And for the Jazz Police, thank you very much for coming. This has been the Bristol No Show. Thank you very much, and good night.